Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Ryan Chandra. Ryan is a data and AI investment lead with Accenture Ventures. Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. Let's start with Accenture. What's the fund's investment thesis?
Absolutely. So Accenture broadly, as your audience may or may not know, 800,000 person company, $200 billion in market cap. We are the world's leading advisor for the Global 2000 Fortune 500. And we provide end-to-end systems integrating, management consulting, design type services for our clients. Now, when it comes to Accenture Ventures, we are Accenture's corporate venture capital arm. We are the six-person investment team that drives all of the investments that Accenture does into emerging technology companies. The premise behind the fund, Christian, and the value we deliver to founders is a couple-fold. Number one, we have found historically it is really hard to work with companies like Accenture. We're so big and so bureaucratic, it can be really challenging to break into this giant elephant that is an 800,000 person company. On the flip side, there is so much that Accenture can bring to cap tables and to founders. When you think about our client access, our distribution capabilities, Accenture as a customer, and especially the insights on the enterprise workflows that founders desperately need to reach product market fit, we feel like we have a better sense of those than almost anyone. And so the premise of Accenture Ventures is, can we use investment as a vehicle to solve the first problem, which is how challenging it can be to work with a large company, and to access the knowledge of the second point. And so we pick 10 to 15 companies a year, enterprise technology, these days everything is data and AI, that we feel like are going to be unique and differentiated. And the point, Christian, is we do not just invest and just wipe our hands and be like, all right, all done. We invest to partner. So we are investing with the goal of bringing you to our clients, bringing you into Accenture, and accelerating your journey of product market fit.
How long has Accenture been operating a fund?
So we've been through a few different phases, but this most recent iteration is about 5 years old.
Ah, and do you guys invest on or off balance sheet?
We invest off balance sheet.
And then how much discretion does Accenture give the managers for purposes of cutting checks?
We are very tightly tied to Accenture as a company. And the reason for that, it goes to the core principle that every CVC has to ask themselves, which is, why do we exist? What is our value into the company? For Accenture Ventures, our number one KPI is strategic impact.
Okay.
So our goal is to drive strategic impact for Accenture as a customer and for our clients. And because of that, as an example, for every investment we do, the head of that business group, so whoever is supporting that at a global management committee level, agrees to sponsor that investment. So they are committing time, dollars, energies, resources, et cetera, to building and executing a joint strategy with that emerging company. So we are very closely tied, and it's very intentional because that's how we achieve our KPIs.
Got it. So Accenture's expertise is broad. It runs, I presume, almost every single industry in the country. Do you find, though, that there are enterprise application themes that Accenture gravitates towards, or at least maybe in the last year or two?
You know, these days, Christian, everything is about data and AI, which is perhaps unsurprising. And specifically, you know, we have found that our clients are looking for capabilities that allow them to accelerate their journey on the Gen AI productivity scale. I think you have seen this as well as I have, which is to say, many of the Fortune 500 Global 2000 are still in that experimentation and POC type phase when it comes to Gen AI. And they're looking to actually deliver real business ROI vis-a-vis our Gen AI. And we feel like emerging tech companies play a critical role in accelerating that journey by increasing trust, by providing a vertical workflow, by providing a capability they might not otherwise have. There will be opportunities where Accenture brings services to the table. There will be capabilities that the hyperscalers and platform players bring to the table, but there will be some capabilities that only startups can do.
Yep.
And by marrying all those things together, by being the village leader of sorts that can bring together everyone in the ecosystem, that's when we deliver value to our clients.
It makes great sense. And I just reading between the lines, though, I infer that there's no specific focus on individual industries per se.
We're industry agnostic, to put it another way, right? So we've invested heavily in financial services, we've invested heavily in life sciences, we have a focus on autonomous supply chains and manufacturing. We have a focus similarly on, public sector and federal. So, Accenture works with all of them. We are a firm believer, nonetheless, that a core part of being successful as a startup is, yes, you have a wide TAM, but you execute specific to a vertical, specific to a workflow. And so one of our goals, Christian, is to bring that industry expertise to founders. And we feel like that's a unique space that we can play in. Because as an example, in financial services, we don't just work with JPMorgan Chase. We also work with Citibank. We work with Wells Fargo. We work with all the tier one banks in the US and globally. So when a founder asks a question, hey, what is it like to sell into financial services of the US for a tier one bank versus selling to a tier one bank in Asia? How many folks can answer that question? Pretty limited number, right? And so that's where we feel like we really bring value.
Well, I mean, I think you're highlighting one of the reasons I'm really grateful you accepted our invite to come on the podcast, because in my experience, you have a whole host of founders who are not as familiar with corporate VCs as they are financial. And, if I was a founder and I was reaching the point where I was ready to raise financing, I'd absolutely,
Totally.
consider, reaching out to Accenture to see whether or not there's a fit, because
Totally.
both know that, revenue is the prime derivative of growth.
Yep.
And if there's an opportunity to have someone on your cap table who already has existing relationships with companies who have you be your potential clients, I mean, in simplest terms, it's a no-brainer.
Absolutely. I'll give you a statistic, Christian, to illustrate the point. PitchBook did a study on US venture capital spend up through about early June. Do you want to guess the percent of money in US VC spending into AI that came from CVCs?
Oh, wow. I'm only going to get this wildly right or wildly wrong. I'm going to go the wild. I'm going to go 5%.
75%.
Yeah. See, I knew it was going to be one.
So 75% of US VC AI spending came from CVCs. If that illustrates the point of how important it is to be engaging with whether it's the hyperscalers, the platform players, industry leaders, or folks like Accenture.
It's fascinating. See, and I think maybe you just illustrated the point that you have this entire segment of the early stage ecosystem that is very attuned to where the market is heading. And, kudos to them for, ponying up. I don't know if it's a great way to characterize it, but, coming to the table and, bringing liquidity. Because we know that the financial CVC counterparts are dealing with a handful of challenges that my senses don't exist on the corporate side. Different mandates, different views of interest rates, and where to take risk. So that's brilliant.
And our ROI is especially unique in AI, I would say, Christian, versus almost any other technology. If you think about what the differentiators are and what kind of value CVCs can bring to the table, there is the compute aspect of things, there's the data aspect of things, there's the credential of having that person as a customer, and there's that workflow expertise. Right. And whether you are an industry leader or a hyperscaler or someone like Accenture, there's remarkable ability to bring value specific to AI. Right. Because AI is only as effective as the data it's trained on. AI is only as effective as the workflow it's applied to. And those are all areas where CVCs can bring unparalleled and for even unfair advantages in the venture capital and financing landscape.
I mean, it makes great sense. And I mean, to a degree, you can argue you have an unfair advantage relative to your financial counterparts just by virtue of the relationship with the corporation. Ryan, it would be great if we could take a moment to step back. I'd love to know your career progression leading up to Accenture and what's formed your view of the investing world today.
Absolutely. So, Christian, I am very much a product of the Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. I grew up in the area. Both my parents worked in tech. My dad has been the CEO of small companies, worked in big tech. I remember, going to high school in Mountain View, and so I was, a stone's throw away from the Google office and others. And so, Christian, you grow up in an area like that really influences you, and I kind of had that passion and interest in emerging technology for a long time. I went to Stanford University for undergrad, so really, took a long commute, all 3, 4 miles to go to school. And there studied the intersection of policy, business, and tech. And while I was at Stanford, I did two internships at Accenture. The first was in a design thinking, innovation strategy type role. The second was in more of a sales strategy type role. And I just loved the different kinds of experiences I could have. I mean, the 2 summers were wildly different. And that's what led me to join full time was like, hey, I can have almost 15 different careers at this one company, and I don't need to change companies and I can still have this diversity of experience. And so that's what I decided to do. I graduated in 2021. I spent a year on the strategy and consulting side, did 5 different projects in consulting, and a lot of plus one side of desk work in and around the startup space. And ultimately was lucky enough that a spot opened up on Accenture Ventures. I joined October 31st, 2022. I started in more of a portfolio management type role, so more so driving reporting, et cetera. And then eventually found a gap and an opportunity around data and AI. As ChatGPT comes out in November of that year, so it's very timely. And so then I became Accenture's data and AI investment lead, and I've been doing that for several years now.
Wow. Congratulations for getting into one of the, what, top 10, not top, if not top 5 competitive undergrad programs in the
Thank
country.
you.
I'm curious though, it's not often that we have guests on the podcasts who are in the heart of Silicon Valley. Sitcoms devoted to the culture. Can you give us an insider's view? Is there any truth to maybe some a lot of perceptions? At least.
I love that question. I will say, Christian, and I'm a little bit biased, having been, essentially raised and spent most of my life in this area, that I do think the Silicon Valley is a special place, and I do think that unique confluence of the diversity of thought and people, the university access with UC Berkeley and Stanford and other great schools in the area, and the history of technology companies that have turned over the last several decades, and that constant cycle of innovation does make the Silicon Valley a little bit of a special place. The example I often point to is, the Sun Microsystems office was this huge office right out over out in the Menlo Park area that became the Meta office, right? And so you see over time how this kind of creative destruction, right? And I do think the Silicon Valley embraces that. And so when you go to coffee shops and you go to happy hours and you go to events, the talk of the town is generally tech oriented, especially these days, it is generally AI oriented. But that all is to say, by no means do you have to be in the Silicon Valley to build a great company, to build a great fund, to invest in awesome companies. I'm really interested in the Silicon Valleys around the world, places like Paris, places like New York, places like Singapore that are becoming technology hubs. But the Bay Area will always have a soft spot in my heart.
I mean, super exciting. And whenever I make my visits, you can the innovation is palpable. Maybe it's a good way to describe it.
Absolutely.
I'm curious. There's been a lot of funds, at least I've spoke with over the years that op intentionally operate in the Rockies, in the Mid-Con, outside of metropolitan New York and the Bay Area. And part of their position is that they can be they point out that valuations can end up higher, just due to concentration of investors pursuing deals. On the flip side, if we look at returns geographically, Silicon Valley continues to outperform. I'm curious, is do you find that that's a conversation topic when you're making investments that maybe you're paying up?
Not especially. I think more than ever, venture capital is flat. I think COVID was an accelerant of that. But these days with virtual mediums, it's not hard to get in touch anywhere. And at Accenture Ventures, we've invested in over 15 different countries, so we do have that global mandate. We look around the world, around the country. Certainly there are pros and cons to building in any one given area. As an example, I was talking with one of our portfolio companies that was based in San Francisco and decided to move to New York. And the rationale is they wanted to be closer to their customers, and they felt like a lot of their customers in the entertainment spaces and fashion and retail, et cetera, were going to be more New York based. versus in San Francisco, they'd be more tech-based. So I think every company has to follow their own journey. From the investor perspective, I haven't seen much concern as far as where the company is located, as much as how well they're performing and how their geographic location might influence that.
Interesting. You mentioned other cities throughout the world. Does your how much of your focus spreads beyond the US?
We are agnostic when it comes to country. I mean, Accenture services clients around the world, and as a result, our fund focuses around the world. We just announced, as an example, our first investment in Singapore. We have invested across Europe, in Israel. We've invested, to our northern friends in Canada as well as in the United States. And so we very much take that global perspective. We're on the hunt to find the best companies. And to us, it doesn't matter where the company is located as long as they are delivering unique and differentiated value to their clients and they're building great products.
Interesting. If you can give us any insider scoop, what's it like when you start to leave the US culture and work with founders in different nations?
It's a good question. From our standpoint, it's all about that tight execution, right? And so as much as it's great to have a wide TAM, really the focus is on building great companies and then executing on your technology and product roadmap to make that happen. So as an example, if you are based in the APAC region and you are selling to APAC clients, it's a completely different environment as it relates to the sales cycles and the cultural differences and things like that. And so it's important to have that local influence and that local perspective when you're selling into those markets. Similarly, from a tech stack perspective, we've certainly seen moments in time where localizing your technology, localizing your models, localizing your data, your data centers to specific geographies might give you an advantage on your journey, right? So it's all for us about that execution. And if that geographic location allows you to execute in a way that makes your company the most successful that it can be.
Makes great sense. So let's come back to the fund. I'd love to talk some just macro investment themes. So obviously you're focused on artificial intelligence. Love to hear your opinion on what you think the next 12 to 24 months has in store for us.
It's a great question, Christian. The word that comes to mind for me is convergence. And I'll explain that in a couple different ways. One is the convergence of technologies. So there's been such a focus, Christian, in the last 6 to 12 months around agentic technology, as an example. Is this agentic? How agentic is it? How autonomous is it? Oh, and all those non-agentic companies, let's not worry about them. And I think more than ever, we are seeing the convergence of different kinds of AI and data technologies together into one unified tech stack. So as an example, if you're familiar with neurosymbolic systems, it is combining predictive AI with generative AI. And that allows you to get the determinism of predictive AI with the creativity of generative AI. And so increasingly see the convergence of technologies into specific tech stacks, into specific architectures. Similarly, the convergence of AI into hyper-specific vertical workflows, right? So normal technology lifecycle, companies start horizontal. Over time, they verticalize. We're certainly seeing that in AI, where you are, as an example, within the customer service space, not just seeing the broad-based CX companies that we're all familiar with, but CX for healthcare, CX for financial services, things like that. So that hyper-verticalization, the convergence of AI and technology with the industry workflow is certainly coming into play. And the last is the convergence of business models, right? So there have been so many different types of technologies and types of business models out there. For a long time, it was all about SaaS software and services. And those two existed in completely different universes. And increasingly, we are seeing the convergence of the software model and the services model into services as a software or some combination therein. Similarly, we often talked about software margins and hardware margins as being completely different things. And with physical AI, those two things are coming together. So I think the convergence of business models is happening as well. Hence the phraseology there.
Do you think that's a pendulum swinging, or do you think that this is a natural path for the use of AI?
Which component?
The convergence of hardware, software services.
I do think this is more of a momentum shift and a more permanent shift versus something that's going to swing back and forth. I'll give you an example on the software and services side. The services market is significantly larger than the software market, right? And for a long time, that has been untapped. And we are now seeing with AI, the move from more of a people-based pricing model to more of a value-based pricing model, where you can use AI to automate 20, 30, 50% of the work. And I just think that the opportunity is in front of some of the companies that are building in that direction. That's the way that Accenture is also reinventing ourselves, is so high, that that is more of a permanent shift than a temporary one.
So with that, there's been discussions of people who are asking, what happens to white collar jobs if there's now a big focus to leverage AI agents to automate otherwise rote, mundane back office tasks. Love to know your opinion of where you think where this heads and what it looks like on the other side.
Yeah, it's a good question. For me, it is all about preparing yourself for that future and building an AI-ready workforce, versus being afraid of it, right? So our former CTO, Paul Daugherty, wrote this book called Human Plus Machine. And I thought that was a very prescient framing for the problem statement, even before, ChatGPT and all these things, because increasingly we are using AI as a collaboration tool, as a thought partner. And I do think that is a superpower and a value add and a democratizing force, versus in general something to be afraid of. So at Accenture, as an example, we've invested heavily in reskilling our own workforce. We've invested heavily in building learning platforms through our platform LearnVantage that is reskilling our clients' workforces to be more AI ready. I think every investor, every founder, every software engineer, every marketer should be playing around with the tools every day, should be experimenting. Should be exploring how it can automate the more drudgery parts of their workflow to make their job more fun, to make their job more efficient, and ultimately to create the workforce of the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. I generally tend towards being wired as an optimist. And so parallels I like to use is the advent of the steam engine or the car. It was just a reallocation of capital.
Right.
Stagecoaches used to be efficient.
Right.
So did typewriters, but people are still working today. And so I find myself having these conversations of, if this really is just a reallocation of capital and it's going to now allow people to be more efficient, what are the other opportunities?
Totally. Totally. I mean, the arc of human history, the arc of human progress is one to where it's just up-leveling from lower-level tasks,
That's
right?
right.
And when I think about AI, let's just pick a specific persona. Like the software developer is the most logical one, and we've seen some really successful companies in that space. Formerly, software engineers were spending a lot of time hands on keyboard coding on really bo like boring and dull tasks like documentation, testing, and root cause analysis, debugging. All these things that's not what you go into software engineering. You don't go into software engineering because you want to spend a lot of time debugging. You go because you want to build amazing transformational products, right? And so if we can arm each software developer with 10 background SDLC agents, that doesn't get rid of the software developer job. It just uplevels it and changes them to software developer managers. They're managing agents. And I tend to think that that future is very exciting.
I think your analysis is spot on. One of the I think one of the long poles in the tent that I see are, so you're still going to need someone to validate intent.
Right.
Because and I'm sure it'll come. An example that I use is Waymo. Waymo, you can put in a location, it has your intent, right? So with the right degree of coding and sensors, you can get from point A to point B. And so, depending on what workflow we're looking at, it just may take a little bit longer
Totally.
to, write code that can ultimately discern intent. I don't know
Yep.
how far that is, but to your point, I still think you'll just have people who are going to have to check the work,
Totally.
until you get to the Waymo point.
Totally. I mean, that idea of human in the loop is a, obviously that technology term that's used in AI a lot. I think it can and will be used more strategically just to describe the way that we engage with technology and workflows, right? And as an example, the kinds of conversation that you and I are having right now, these kinds of human-to-human moments, whether it is a podcast or interviewing someone, whether it is a marketer thinking about their consumer, whether it is a law firm thinking about their their partner, all of those things are still going to happen. It's just that the follow-up work that happens out of it, the tactical ask, the action items, things like that, that's the part that's going to change. And so the strategy element, the human to human empathy element of it, the intent, to your point, I don't think that's going anywhere.
Agreed. And I think if anything, it amplifies opportunity to even be more creative,
Yes.
because now you're free from just rote, repetitive tasks.
100%, 100%.
There's another theme that I see, and I'd love to get your take, and that's around robotics. And so it seems like it's a natural outcome. We're recording this in late June. Tesla just announced the launch of robotaxis. I'm sure many in our audience have seen clips of Optimus, and you have a whole host of companies who are doing some pretty amazing work on, it's your point, marrying artificial intelligence with hardware.
Yep.
Do you see this as a one of many themes or a main theme as the technology matures?
I'll frame it a little bit differently in that I think physical AI is a main theme, which is to say, shifting from the first users of AI were primarily digital in nature. Software engineering, marketing, contact centers, lawyers, all of these are primarily people interacting with their computer. We're now moving beyond that, right? So how will AI transform the manufacturing floor? How will it transform the retail store? How will it transform the home with home devices and smart devices and things like that? That is the next big opportunity. And we are seeing that tech stack emerge, called an edge AI tech stack in some cases, of edge specific models, edge data lakes, edge data capabilities, edge AI applications. Similarly, in robotics, you have the robotics tech stack emerging. Robotic specific models, robotics testing and eval, robotics orchestration, things like that, right? And obviously the hardware component as well. At Accenture Ventures, as an example, we invested in Sanctuary AI, which is one of those companies that is building towards humanoid robots. So we certainly see this broader category of moving AI from the laptop to the manufacturing floor to the store as being one of the core themes for the next 12 to 24 to 36 months.
Super encouraging. And so I'd love to get your take on just maybe nation opportunity. So, when I find myself in conversations with founders, I like to frame it as you're bringing to the market solutions to problems, not features and functions.
Right.
So what are some of the rate limiting steps? What are some of the problems, i.e. rate limiting steps that you see today where an entrepreneur can roll up their sleeves and build a company to solve some problems that you find are just top of mind within Accenture.
I think the most exciting thing, Christian, is that AI has unlocked a set of use cases that we thought were largely untouchable. Through technology, right? So again, some of those core use cases were pretty well standard and well understood. But in a pre-AI era, it was a little bit harder to imagine, as an example, AI supporting insurance underwriting and claims management. It was a little bit harder to see technology disrupting the government procurement process or drug discovery, right? And I think AI represents a step change where those workflows that we thought were going to be harder to crack are now actually achievable. So the number one category that I would be building in if I was a founder is vertical AI, which is to say, what is the area and the problem statement and the workflow that you are deeply passionate about? What is the problem that only you can solve? Even if you are a non-technical founder, but you are a scientist with 10 years of research experience, or you are someone who's been in and around fintech and financial services and tier one banks for 10, 20 years, the door is suddenly open to you to build $100 million, $1 billion companies in these vertical spaces and define differentiation from some of the platform players and the hyperscalers. So I think vertical AI, and specifically in these legacy industries, these hard to solve problems, that's what I would be going after.
Yeah, and it seems like there's this window right now. I don't know how long it stays open where there is going to be a premium on domain expertise,
Yep.
because it's going to require that knowledge
Yep.
to inform the development of these solutions.
And empathy, right? I mean, if you believe, Christian, as I do, that the underlying intelligence and model is being commoditized, right? Then where is differentiation going to come? How do you build defensibility as a founder? If it's not the model, which for 90% of folks it isn't, then it is either the data you're bringing to the table, so hard to access, but domain expertise certainly helps. The capabilities you might build, but software is easier to build than ever. And so then you get to things like distribution or things like customer empathy, right? Or team, right? And that becomes your defensibility in the era of AI software development. And for those kinds of things, to your point, that domain expertise is more critical than ever.
I agree with all your points. If there was one more I'd add to the list, it's something you referenced earlier, and that's the marriage of the software to hardware, where I've seen iPhone's a great example.
Right.
Arguably the software is as successful as it is because of the marriage,
Right.
the hardware. And I only call that out because I find myself in a lot of conversations with founders who are intimidated by manufacturing. And I don't blame them. I mean, on the surface, it could seem overwhelming. It's capital intensive. Where do you start? But I definitely think it's another avenue to be bullish on.
Right.
And just by virtue of the fact it's also challenging. And if
Yeah.
two challenging problems, you're going to have less competition.
Absolutely. Agreed.
So I think that's a natural jump off to due diligence. I'd love to get your take. You've identified a company. There seems to be alignment with either Accenture or the corporation or its clients. What's the lens that you look at opportunities through?
That's a great question, Christian. There's a set of things that every investor looks at, the market size and the timing, the tech stack, the financials, the legal, and when we can talk about all these things. I think the one thing that I'll call out that might make Accenture Ventures a little bit different or unique is enterprise readiness. Because enterprise readiness is the critical factor to a CVC like Accenture that wants to then turn around and take this technology to our clients and to similarly bring insights back to the company. So I'll give you an example in a specific industry. When we look at the CFO tech stack, right, the office of the CEO, CFO, one that you're very familiar with, one of the, no-brainer starting points for us is how do you integrate into the existing tech stack? Because by and large, our clients are not going to be ripping out SAP. They're not going to be ripping out their ERP system, right? And so how do you complement or work alongside that kind of technology? And I've talked to some really incredible startups in this space, but they're still building towards things like having an SAP integration. Right. And until that happens, that makes it a little bit challenging for us to really work with that company. Similarly, from a go-to-market perspective, while it is not a prerequisite to have, 15 Fortune 500 customers, if you do have some demonstrated traction, if you do have some of those larger deals, that production style deployments on your go-to-market and on your financials, that helps us to understand how we might be able to work with you in the future. So enterprise readiness and specifically fit for Fortune 500 is something that Accenture Ventures that looks at really, really closely.
Yeah, I think great insight. And I even think, fortunately today you have entire companies who are devoted to API integrations.
Right.
Whereas in the past, you'd have to devote a whole host of product development budgets just to building those pipes to begin with. So fortunately, I'm not a developer myself per se, but the sense I get is easier than it has been in the past.
Yep.
And then, I think every founder agrees. It's like it makes good sense. Show me that you can support an enterprise client. The biggest counsel that I would get is that, if you're thinking about pipeline management, yes, you have a focus on enterprise company, but also, depending on how well capitalized you are, throw some small and medium-sized businesses in
Of
there.
course. Of course. In many ways, you have to grow into that, which is, totally fine, right? You start smaller and you work your way upstream, and that's totally fine. But enterprise readiness, I think, to us at Accenture Ventures, is a strategy decision as much as anything else, right? If you're going to try to sell to the largest companies in the world, the whole company from product to sales to engineering kind of has to be strategically aligned to make that happen because it can be so grueling. Now, our goal at Accenture Ventures is to make that easier. We're trying to be the lingua franca between the Fortune 500 and these startups. But, having that strategy and that commitment from those companies is pretty kind of critical as part of our due diligence process to ensure that this successful partnership happens down
I love it. Founders take heed,
the line.
Ryan, a whole host of great insights. Before we wrap up, enjoy asking a retrospective.
Please.
It's basically if you had an opportunity to go back to have a conversation with your younger self, you pick the what would you share?
Jump in, dive in. I felt, when I first really started breaking into venture capital, 23, 24 years old, something like that, right? And you're in the room with CEOs and managing partners at venture funds, and it can be a little bit overwhelming at times, and so there were times I was a little bit hesitant to ask the question or to jump into the conversation. And if I could advise myself anything, is that the sooner you just jump into the deep end, the better off you're going to be in driving success in future, right? So I would encourage my previous self, as well as anyone who's interested in breaking into venture capital, go to events, go to conferences, go to talks, talk to as many people as you can, try to become a subject matter expert as quickly as possible, because it is a positive flywheel that will benefit you for the rest of your career.
Do you think either yourself or your peers, do you feel like maybe there was hesitation because you're just earlier in your career? And if that's the case, do you think you should embrace it?
Yes and yes. I think certainly when you're talking to a five-time repeat CEO who's done this before and seen everything, it can be a little bit challenging to be the young fly on the wall who's just trying to get their feet wet. That being said, age is just a number. I think what matters is expertise. And so your ability to deliver value to that person by bringing them a perspective or an insight that they hadn't had before, that's what makes you special. And it
Yeah.
doesn't matter if you're 16 years old or 66 years old.
I agree more. I find myself framing it as you miss one. I didn't come up with this, but whoever did gets credit. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Wayne Gretzky. Nope.
There you go. Thank you. So shout out to Wayne. But I couldn't agree more. I mean, especially I feel like when you're early in your career, you have everything to gain and nothing or very little to lose. So thank you. Last question. A whole host of people, generally have a material impact on us over a course of our life. Anyone personally or professionally you'd love to give a shout out to?
Two folks. The first is my dad. My dad, in many ways, is the inspiration for me and my career. I mentioned the fact that he's been an operator for a very long time, small companies, large companies. And what I most admire about him, if I can get a little bit sentimental, is in spite of the busyness of his career, he never, forgot about his family. I never felt like he missed a game that I had or missed being there, because he was so committed to his family as well as his work.
What's your dad's
So Arun.
room?
So that is Arun is an inspiration for me. The other is my boss, Tom Lunabos. So Tom is a six-time entrepreneur. He had four acquisitions and two IPOs. So he went 6 for 6 in the Valley, which is an incredibly rare feat. And yet at the same time, is remarkably humble and is extremely keen on giving back. And
Awesome.
that willingness to basically coach the next generation, to bring folks along, to share his insights. He has been an incredible teammate. I've learned a lot from him. Hopefully, I've taught him a couple of things here and there too. So it has been a pleasure to work with Tom as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you to Arun and Tom for devoting themselves to, what seems to be an amazing career. And I'm sure, man, long road ahead still. So we're gonna have to have you back.
Thanks, Christian.
So, if there are any members of our audience who would like to get a hold of you or learn more about Accenture Ventures, how could they find you?
LinkedIn would be the best way. I am one of the rare people that actually checks my LinkedIn. So feel free to Google my name, RYANCHANDRA. I'm sure I'll pop up, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
Fantastic. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Ryan Chandra. Ryan, again, is the data and AI investment lead at Accenture Ventures. Ryan, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And again, our pleasure. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO, FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.